Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark. Good
morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing very well. How are you today?
I'm well indeed, and I actually was amused this morning by a new feature from Zagat.com. Does everyone out there know what Zagat restaurant survey is? Oh, wait, I hear someone saying, no, I don't know what it is. Let's answer that.
The Zagat survey is basically a survey, and it's available in most major cities in the United States and throughout the world, and most major areas. For instance, New Jersey has its own book. New York City has its own book. L.A. has its own book. San Francisco has its own book. And you buy the book for the area, either for which you live or for which you're going to travel, and it's a rating pretty much based on the ratings of other people like yourself who've been in those restaurants.
So it's a reader survey, but what's funny is they publish very good information. I use it as a restaurant guide as much as anything else, not so much for the points that it gives you, rates you on points of food, service, and decor, but I use it for the, and they also have a little blurb, one or two paragraphs, where they try to give you a representative sample of what is said about
what
the
people going to the restaurants feeling or comments are about those restaurants.
And what's funny is that I use Zagat online a lot because for me it works great to find addresses. If I want to get a list of restaurants in a certain neighborhood, it will find them for me.
And they have a lot of lists like that too. You know, I want a romantic restaurant. I want a restaurant with a fireplace. I want a restaurant with an outdoor cafe. Whatever you're looking for in a certain neighborhood.
Okay, so that's Zagat.com. And Zagat online has a bunch of great services. They'll send you an email that says, new restaurant openings in your area or restaurant closings, things like that. But the service that I signed on to Zagat for I forget why, but they had outtakes of the week. There's an outtake of the week every week where they take out what they find to be a particularly amusing comment written by one of their reviewers about certain restaurants. They don't tell you what it's assigned to or it's not necessarily going to be in the guide, but they do one outtake a week. And the outtakes of the week for the last several weeks are my favorite. The only thing healthy about this place is the exit door. Even the ice water had garlic in it.
Yeah, that's a good one. One of my favorite one was, the staff is charmingly incompetent. And that actually reminds me, I actually was reviewing with a restaurant reviewer one time, and we were out in another restaurant and talking about the restaurant, and the server came over and she was quite nice and smiling and hospitable. But she really didn't know anything about anything in the restaurant. And, she was nice and pleasant, and it was nice to talk to her at our table. But she really couldn't give us any help with the service at our table.
Now, if I have to choose between a nice waiter who's somewhat incompetent or a rude waiter who's very competent, believe it or not, I will always choose the nice waiter.
Oh,
who's,
no question
who's
about it. I actually,
nice counts for a lot.
I remember what the person who was reviewing the restaurant said about the service after the server left.
What?
Said, I can sum up the service at this restaurant in one word. You know, it's what I do. And I thought, what's the one word how you could sum up the service in this restaurant? And he said, forgivable.
Oh, there you go.
Okay.
And I think that's a great reviewer, and I know who you're talking about. But I think that's because that's the way that most people view things. You can forget. Look, if you mess up, if you make a mistake, look, I'm not saying I'm gonna keep going back to the restaurant, but I'm not gonna hate you. You can be the greatest restaurant in the world, but I have had people be rude to me. So you know what? It's funny. I went to a restaurant that you and I, and well, this restaurant will remain nameless for this broadcast, but if you listen to the Restaurant Guys regularly, you might figure out what the restaurant is, where you and I have had, I had two of the best meals of my life, and you had one of the best meals of your life, right?
Yep.
I went back to, and it's in Paris, I went back to Paris. The restaurant had moved to a new location, and I went back. had made the reservations from the United States. You made them for me in French.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew I was in the business. And I had a waiter who looked down his nose at me.
That was one of the highlights of that restaurant when we had gone there, was the service.
Let's put it this way.
How really gentle and nice and accommodating the service was.
There. I remember our waiter's name. He was Umberto, which doesn't sound like
the
a
nice
French
waiter.
Name, but he was the nice waiter, mm-hmm. and he waited on me both times that I was at that restaurant, for the first two times that I was at the restaurant, and when we dined together. And I went back this other time, and I got this officious, pompous jerk who spoke English better than I do,
mm-hmm.
And you know what? Technically, everything went off without a hitch.
Right.
But what good does that do you if you're sitting there seething and thinking, am I going to leave or am I not going to leave?
You know,
what I'm thinking the whole time.
It doesn't do you any good at all. You know, that kind of takes me to another thing that I read recently, and I think one of the listeners sent to me. But it was a survey. It was a survey done in Princeton, New Jersey, about why you go back, why you stop going to a restaurant, which I think is to a restaurateur is very important to hear this kind of thing. And I was shocked at the results of this survey, because I would expect that the reason someone doesn't go back to a restaurant is because the food wasn't good enough. Or because maybe the value wasn't good enough, or they didn't give me enough food. But certainly I would expect that the reason a person doesn't go back to a restaurant, the number one reason would be food related.
And what's the number one reason?
The number one reason, 25% of the people who answered this survey, was rude waiters. And to me, yes, that is, looking at
sense.
It makes total sense, because that's the number one reason I wouldn't go back to a restaurant.
You ready for the number two reason? So 25% of people said the number one reason they stop going to a restaurant is a rude waiter. 20% of the people that are coming at the next highest said the reason they would stop is because the host or maitre d' underestimated the waiting time for a table. In other words, you show up at 8 o'clock, you don't sit till 9, unacceptable.
But this has happened to all of us. You know, we go way back to the Patrick O'Connell had. We had Patrick O'Connell from the Inn at Little Washington on the show a long time ago, and he talked about restaurant scars. And that's a scar that most of us have, where someone told us 15 minutes because they didn't want us to leave and go someplace else, when they knew
it was 45.
Full well it was 45 minutes. And listen, I own a restaurant. Once in a while it'll happen where you think you're going to get a table and somebody sits at the table and proposes to the person across from them, and they're staying for 45 minutes.
And they're not getting up.
Because they got to have some champagne and...
Call their mother.
You know, exactly. Call their mother, precisely.
But if you look at these two statistics, rude waiters are 25% of the respondents' number one reason why they won't go back. Host underestimating time for a table is 20%. Well, that's just another form of rude,
mm-hmm.
right? So being rude to someone is 45% of the reason, the number one people's number one reason for not going back to a restaurant. Then comes slow service. Then comes poorly prepared food with 12%.
Poorly prepared food is 12% of the reason that people won't go back to a restaurant. To me, that I just, as a restaurant owner, I can't believe that that's how low a percentage that is compared to everything else.
But as a maitre d', you understand, and as a customer, you understand when you see it on paper, you say to yourself, of course. And I walked out, and when I went to this other restaurant in Paris, it was not inexpensive. I did not order inexpensively. We weren't rude at all. And I walked out of that restaurant thinking, I just dropped probably $1,000 on dinner.
It's probably at that place, you probably spent $1,000 for dinner.
And I feel like I want, and I've never been back.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy opened up a place in New York I haven't been.
Mm-hmm.
And I have his book, and I respect him, and he gave me two of the greatest meals of my life. And you know what? I probably should go back and give him a second chance.
And meal number three, you were treated rudely.
And that was 4 years ago, 5 years ago, and I should probably go back and give him another chance, but that's a lesson learned. Anyway, we'll be back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing very well. How are you today?
I'm well indeed, and I actually was amused this morning by a new feature from Zagat.com. Does everyone out there know what Zagat restaurant survey is? Oh, wait, I hear someone saying, no, I don't know what it is. Let's answer that.
The Zagat survey is basically a survey, and it's available in most major cities in the United States and throughout the world, and most major areas. For instance, New Jersey has its own book. New York City has its own book. L.A. has its own book. San Francisco has its own book. And you buy the book for the area, either for which you live or for which you're going to travel, and it's a rating pretty much based on the ratings of other people like yourself who've been in those restaurants.
So it's a reader survey, but what's funny is they publish very good information. I use it as a restaurant guide as much as anything else, not so much for the points that it gives you, rates you on points of food, service, and decor, but I use it for the, and they also have a little blurb, one or two paragraphs, where they try to give you a representative sample of what is said about
what
the restaurant.
What the people going to the restaurants feeling or comments are about those restaurants.
And what's funny is that I use Zagat online a lot because for me it works great to find addresses. If I want to get a list of restaurants in a certain neighborhood, it will find them for me.
And they have a lot of lists like that too. You know, I want a romantic restaurant. I want a restaurant with a fireplace. I want a restaurant with an outdoor cafe. Whatever you're looking for in a certain neighborhood.
Okay, so that's Zagat.com. And Zagat online has a bunch of great services. They'll send you an email that says, new restaurant openings in your area or restaurant closings, things like that. But the service that I got, I signed on to Zagat for I forget why, but they had outtakes of the week. There's an outtake of the week every week where they take out what they find to be a particularly amusing comment written by one of their reviewers about certain restaurants. They don't tell you what it's assigned to or it's not necessarily going to be in the guide, but they do one outtake a week. And the outtakes of the week for the last several weeks are my favorite. The only thing healthy about this place is the exit door. even the ice water had garlic in it.
That's a good one. One of my favorite one was the staff is charmingly incompetent. And that actually reminds me, I actually was reviewing with a restaurant reviewer one time, and we were out in another restaurant and talking about the restaurant, and the server came over and she was quite nice and smiling and hospitable, but she really didn't know anything about anything in the restaurant. And it, you know, she was nice and pleasant and it was nice to talk to her at our table, but she really couldn't give us any help with the service at our table.
Now, if I have to choose between a nice waiter who's somewhat incompetent or a rude waiter who's very competent, believe it or not, I will always choose the nice waiter.
Oh,
who's,
no question
who's
about
somewhat
it.
Incompetent.
I actually,
nice counts for a lot.
I remember what the person who was reviewing the restaurant said about the service after the server left.
What?
Said, you know, I can sum up the service at this restaurant in one word. You know, it's what I do. And I thought, what's the one word how you could sum up the service in this restaurant? And he said, forgivable.
Oh, there you go.
No, and I thought, okay.
And I think that's a great reviewer, and I know who you're talking about. But I think that's because that's the way that most people view things. You can forget. Look, if you mess up, if you make a mistake, look, I'm not saying I'm gonna keep going back to the restaurant, but I'm not gonna hate you. You can be the greatest restaurant in the world, but I have had people be rude to me. So you know what? It's funny. I went to a restaurant that you and I, and well, this restaurant will remain nameless for this broadcast, but if you listen to the Restaurant Guys regularly, you might figure out what the restaurant is, where you and I have had, I had two of the best meals of my life, and you had one of the best meals of your life, right?
Yep.
I went back to, and it's in Paris, I went back to Paris, the restaurant had moved to a new location, and I went back, had made the reservations from the United States, you made them for me in French, and they knew I was in the business. And I had a waiter who looked down his nose at me.
Oh, which was one of the, for me, that was one of the highlights of that restaurant when we had gone there, was the service.
Let's put it this way.
How really gentle and nice and accommodating the service was.
There. I remember our waiter's name. He was Umberto, which doesn't sound like
the
a
nice
French
waiter.
Name, but he was the nice waiter, and he waited on me both times that I was at that restaurant, for the first two times that I was at the restaurant, and when we dined together. And I went back this other time, and I got this officious, pompous jerk who spoke English better than I do, but just And you know what? Technically, everything went off without a hitch.
Right.
But what good does that do you if you're sitting there seething and thinking, am I going to leave or am I not going to leave?
You know,
that's what I'm thinking the whole time.
It doesn't do you any good at all. You know, that kind of takes me to another thing that I read recently, and I think one of the listeners sent to me. But it was a survey. It was a survey done in Princeton, New Jersey, about why you go back, why you stop going to a restaurant, which I think is to a restaurateur is very important to hear this kind of thing. And I was shocked at the results of this survey, because I would expect that the reason someone doesn't go back to a restaurant is because the food wasn't good enough, or because maybe the value wasn't good enough, or they didn't give me enough food. But certainly I would expect that the reason a person doesn't go back to a restaurant, the number one reason would be food related.
And what's the number one reason?
The number one reason, 25% of the people who answered this survey, was rude waiters. And to me, yes, that is, you know, looking at it, it makes total sense, because that's the number one reason I wouldn't go back to a restaurant.
You ready for the number two reason? So 25% of people said the number one reason they stop going to a restaurant is a rude waiter. 20% of the people that coming at the next highest said the reason they would stop is because the host or maitre d' underestimated the waiting time for a table. In other words, you show up at 8 o'clock, you don't sit till 9, unacceptable.
But this has happened to all of us. You know, we go way back to the Patrick O'Connell. We had Patrick O'Connell from the Inn at Little Washington on the show a long time ago, and he talked about restaurant scars. And that's a scar that most of us have, where someone told us 15 minutes because they didn't want us to leave and go someplace else, when they knew
it was 45,
full well it was 45 minutes. And listen, I own a restaurant. Once in a while it'll happen where you think you're going to get a table and somebody sits at the table and proposes to the person across from them, and they're staying for 45 minutes.
And they're not getting up.
Because they got to have some champagne and
call their mother.
You know, exactly, call their mother, precisely.
But if you look at these two statistics, rude waiters are 25% of the respondents' number one reason why they won't go back. Host underestimating time for a table is 20%. Well, that's just another form of rude,
mm-hmm.
right? So being rude to someone is 45% of the reason, the number one people's number one reason for not going back to a restaurant. Then comes slow service. Then comes poorly prepared food with 12%.
Poorly prepared food is 12% of the reason that people won't go back to a restaurant. To me, that I just, as a restaurant owner, I can't believe that that's how low a percentage that is compared to everything else.
But as a maitre d', you understand, and as a customer, you understand when you see it on paper, you say to yourself, of course. And I walked out, and when I went to this other restaurant in Paris, it was not inexpensive. I did not order inexpensively. We weren't rude at all. And I walked out of that restaurant thinking, I just dropped probably $1,000 on dinner.
That's probably, at that place, we probably spent $1,000 for dinner.
And I feel like I want, and I've never been back. Mm-hmm. And the guy opened up a place in New York. I haven't been. Mm-hmm. And I have his book, and I respect him, and he gave me two of the greatest meals of my life. And you know what? I probably should go back and give him a second chance.
And meal number three, you were treated rudely.
And that was back. 4 years ago, 5 years ago, and I should probably go back and give him another chance, but that's a lesson learned. Anyway, we'll be back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing very well. How are you today?
I'm well indeed, and I actually was amused this morning by a new feature from Zagat.com. Does everyone out there know what Zagat restaurant survey is? Oh, wait, I hear someone saying, no, I don't know what it is. Let's answer that.
The Zagat survey is basically a survey, and it's available in most major cities in the United States and throughout the world, and most major areas. For instance, New Jersey has its own book. New York City has its own book. L.A. has its own book. San Francisco has its own book. And you buy the book for the area, either for which you live or for which you're going to travel. And it's a rating pretty much based on the ratings of other people like yourself who've been in those restaurants.
So it's a reader survey, but what's funny is they publish very good information. I use it as a restaurant guide as much as anything else, not so much for the points that it gives you, rates you on points of food, service, and decor. But I use it for the and they also have a little blurb, one or two paragraphs, where they try to give you a representative sample of what is said about
what
the
people going to the restaurants feeling or comments are about those restaurants.
And what's funny is that I use Zagat online a lot because for me it works great to find addresses. If I want to get a list of restaurants in a certain neighborhood, it will find them for me.
And they have a lot of lists like that too. You know, I want a romantic restaurant. I want a restaurant with a fireplace. I want a restaurant with an outdoor cafe. Whatever you're looking for in a certain neighborhood.
Okay, so that's Zagat.com. And Zagat online has a bunch of great services. They'll send you an email that says, new restaurant openings in your area or restaurant closings, things like that. But the service that I got, I signed on to Zagat for I forget why, but they had outtakes of the week. There's an outtake of the week every week where they take out what they find to be a particularly amusing comment written by one of their reviewers about certain restaurants. They don't tell you what it's assigned to or it's not necessarily going to be in the guide, but they do one outtake a week. And the outtakes of the week for the last several weeks are my favorite. The only thing healthy about this place is the exit door. even the ice water had garlic in it.
Yeah, that's a good one. One of my favorite one was, the staff is charmingly incompetent. And that actually reminds me, I actually was reviewing with a restaurant reviewer one time, and we were out in another restaurant and talking about the restaurant, and the server came over and she was quite nice and smiling and hospitable, but she really didn't know anything about anything in the restaurant. And she was nice and pleasant and it was nice to talk to her at our table, but she really couldn't give us any help with the service at our table.
Now, if I have to choose between a nice waiter who's somewhat incompetent or a rude waiter who's very competent, believe it or not, I will always choose the nice waiter.
Oh,
who's,
no question
who's
about it. I actually,
nice counts for a lot.
I remember what the person who was reviewing the restaurant said about the service after the server left.
What?
Said, I can sum up the service at this restaurant in one word. You know, it's what I do. And I thought, what's the one word how you could sum up the service in this restaurant? And he said, forgivable.
Oh, there you go.
No, and I thought, okay.
And I think that's a great reviewer, and I know who you're talking about. But I think that's because that's the way that most people view things. You can forget. Look, if you mess up, if you make a mistake, look, I'm not saying I'm gonna keep going back to the restaurant, but I'm not gonna hate you. You can be the greatest restaurant in the world, but I have had people be rude to me. So you know what? It's funny. I went to a restaurant that you and I, and well, this restaurant will remain nameless for this broadcast, but if you listen to the Restaurant Guys regularly, you might figure out what the restaurant is, where you and I have had, I had two of the best meals of my life,
yep,
and you had one of the best meals of your life, right?
Yep.
I went back to, and it's in Paris, I went back to Paris, the restaurant had moved to a new location, and I went back, had made the reservations from the United States. You made them for me in French, and they knew I was in the business. And I had a waiter who looked down his nose at me.
Oh, which was one of the, for me, that was one of the highlights of that restaurant when we had gone there, was the service.
Let's put it this way.
How really gentle and nice and accommodating the service was.
There. I remember our waiter's name. He was Umberto, which doesn't sound like
the
a
nice
French
waiter.
Name, but he was the nice waiter, and he waited on me both times that I was at that restaurant, for the first two times that I was at the restaurant, and when we dined together. And I went back this other time, and I got this officious, pompous jerk who spoke English better than I do, but just, and you know what? Technically, everything went off without a hitch.
Right.
But what good does that do you if you're sitting there seething and thinking, am I going to leave or am I not going to leave?
You know,
that's what I'm thinking the whole time.
It doesn't do you any good at all. You know, that kind of takes me to another thing that I read recently, and I think one of the listeners sent to me. But it was a survey. It was a survey done in Princeton, New Jersey, about why you go back, why you stop going to a restaurant, which I think is to a restaurateur is very important to hear this kind of thing. And I was shocked at the results of this survey because I would expect that the reason someone doesn't go back to a restaurant is because the food wasn't good enough, or because maybe the value wasn't good enough, or they didn't give me enough food. But certainly I would expect that the reason a person doesn't go back to a restaurant, the number one reason would be food related.
And what's the number one reason?
The number one reason, 25% of the people who answered this survey, was rude waiters. And to me, yes, that is, you know, looking at
sense.
It makes total sense, because that's the number one reason I wouldn't go back to
a
restaurant.
You ready for the number two reason? So 25% of people said the number one reason they stopped going to a restaurant is a rude waiter. 20% of the people that coming at the next highest said the reason they would stop is because the host or maitre d' underestimated the waiting time for a table. In other words, you show up at 8 o'clock, you don't sit till 9. Unacceptable.
But this has happened to all of us. You know, we go way back to the Patrick O'Connell. We had Patrick O'Connell from the Inn at Little Washington on the show a long time ago, and he talked about restaurant scars. And that's a scar that most of us have, where someone told us 15 minutes because they didn't want us to leave and go someplace else, when they knew
it was 45,
full well it was 45 minutes. And listen, I own a restaurant. Once in a while it'll happen where you think you're going to get a table and somebody sits at the table and proposes to the person across from them, and they're staying for 45 minutes.
And they're not getting up.
Because they got to have some champagne and
call their mother.
You know, exactly, call their mother, precisely.
But if you look at these two statistics, rude waiters are 25% of the respondents' number one reason why they won't go back. Host underestimating time for a table is 20%. Well, that's just another form of rude,
mm-hmm.
right? So being rude to someone is 45% of the reason, the number one people's number one reason for not going back to a restaurant. Then comes slow service. Then comes poorly prepared food with 12%.
Poorly prepared food is 12% of the reason that people won't go back to a restaurant. To me, that I just, as a restaurant owner, I can't believe that that's how low a percentage that is compared to everything else.
But as a maitre d', you understand, and as a customer, you understand when you see it on paper, you say to yourself, of course. And I walked out, and when I went to this other restaurant in Paris, it was not inexpensive. I did not order inexpensively. We weren't rude at all. And I walked out of that restaurant thinking, I just dropped probably $1,000 on dinner.
It's probably, at that place, you probably spent $1,000 for two.
And I feel like I want, and I've never been back. Mm-hmm. And the guy opened up a place in New York I haven't been. Mm-hmm. And I have his book, and I respect him, and he gave me two of the greatest meals of my life. And you know what? I probably should go back and give him a second chance.
And meal number three, you were treated rudely.
And that was 4 years ago, 5 years ago, and I should probably go back and give him another chance, but that's a lesson learned. Anyway, we'll be back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Today, our guest is Claudia Roden. Claudia is a food writer born and brought up in Cairo. Ms. Roden is the author of many books, including the new book of Middle Eastern food, the book of Jewish food, and Odyssey from Samarkand to New York, Coffee, a Connoisseur's Companion. She's here today to discuss her book, Arabesque, A Taste of Morocco, Turkey, and Lebanon.
Claudia, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me on.
What a lovely book, both visually and literarily. What a lovely book you've written. Why do you feel this book was necessary, and what's the focus of it within the context of Middle Eastern cuisine?
Yes. Well, I had been writing about the Middle East food for very many years, and I had been. Exactly. My first book came out almost 40 years ago.
Wow.
And, yes. And I have been traveling there and going there for conferences, going to festivals, going to work with people there in various countries, and collecting more recipes and finding out more. And my own way of cooking here in England also... I have had not changes, but I have evolved. I've worked with professional cooks. When I wrote my first book and when I collected the major part of my first book, really from people, it was a time when I had left Egypt, and most or almost all of my family and the Jewish community had left because of the Suez Crisis. That's when I started collecting recipes, not thinking that it would be for a book, but to record our heritage. And I was asking everybody that we met, and we met lots of people who were on their way somewhere or other to settle in a new country. Some people came to America. Lots of them came to went to America, to Latin America. Almost every corner of the world now, I've got either a relative or very old family friends. But I would really ask for recipes because recipes, printed recipes, just didn't exist.
But
there wasn't a single book in Egypt, either in French, which was the language we spoke to each other, or English, or in Italian, or in Arabic. And so, in a way, a lot of the recipes had never been in print. And that's how I started work. And I wrote exactly every word that people said.
Well, in a lot of cultures, that's how we've passed our heritage from one generation to the next, is through the recipes.
Yes. But then, by all these years since that time, I have refined my way of cooking. In a way, I didn't want to change anything that people had told me at the time, but the people who had told me recipes at the time also have changed with me, because life has changed, and we've got different equipment, also different ideas of health. And so over the years, after having collected lots more recipes, everybody that I meet almost tells me, you know, there is one way that I do this, or there's one recipe that you haven't got in your book. And
you know, speaking of, we have one for your next book. We're ready to submit to you.
Well, I'm glad, because that's what, anyhow, it's fascinating how it never ends. But then, just a few years ago, my existing publisher said, can you do another book for us? And I said, you know, I've got so many, I've done all that big book, I can't enlarge it. They said, no, we don't want you to enlarge it, but can you do a new book? And then they suggested, instead of doing all the Middle East and North Africa and putting all the recipes together without differentiating the countries, to actually choose three countries and separate them in different parts of a book, and to choose the best countries.
Well, I think here in the United States, there's not a lot of consideration for the different countries and the different cuisines that come from the different countries. We kind of lump that whole Middle Eastern cuisine as one kind of lump sum, as opposed to the different traditions coming from different countries.
Are we foolish for doing that?
Well, you know, I was attacked by an Arab journalist for being the cause of that.
Really?
Yes. I mean, when Arabesque came out, he said, why are you doing it now, and shouldn't you have done that before? Because you have caused really all these chefs in London and America, because it was the first book, and all the first big book, I suppose, to actually use any recipe as though it is from the same area. And there was not such a thing as Middle Eastern or North African food. There was a cuisine of Egypt, of Lebanon, of Syria, of Turkey. But, and you put them all together regardless.
But by the same token, I think that people in England and people in the United States are less apt to accept and embrace a specific cuisine until they've embraced the general cuisine. And I think the same thing happened here in the United States, at least, with Italian food. We used to have Italian restaurants, and we still have Italian restaurants, and now we have regional Italian restaurants that are very different. Hey, Claudia, we need to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a moment talking more with Claudia Roden about her book, Arabesque, A Taste of Morocco, Turkey, and Lebanon. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi. And we're speaking with Claudia Roden, one of the world's great experts on Middle Eastern cuisine, about her book, Arabesque, A Taste of Morocco, Turkey, and Lebanon. Claudia, now you've written so extensively for a Western audience about Middle Eastern cuisine in general, and these three cuisines in particular here. One of the things in the little bit of traveling that I've done in the Middle East is that I've noticed is there is so much street food in the Middle East, and some of that street food makes it into your books, certainly. Do you draw the distinction between the food of the home and street food?
Yes. Let's say, talking in a few of the countries now, they've eliminated the street food for hygienic reasons. Like in Turkey, they had hundreds of vendors a few decades ago, and now they don't. But in Morocco, there are still street foods, and also in Egypt. And the thing is that some of the street food is, let's say, it has the same culture. It's part of the same culture as the home cooking. And in some cases, it's similar dishes, like there are tagines. But at home, where people would put saffron, for instance, in the street, it's poor food, and they would put turmeric. And it is what is used,
and
whether it's cheap or expensive. By the way, I should say that when I started writing, I called my book a book of Middle Eastern food, and it had North African dishes, because in those days they would lump North Africa with the Middle East. But now North Africa doesn't want to be part of the Middle East. So nowadays we differentiate.
And I just want to point out for our listeners, the saffron is one of the world's most expensive spices, while turmeric is an average spice. And when Claudia was talking about the difference between street cuisine and the cuisine at home, it's that someone at home would use saffron, but on your street vendor was never going to use the very expensive saffron. Hey, we're going to break for the news. We'll come right back and talk more with Claudia Roden about her wonderful book, Arabesque, A Taste of Morocco, Turkey, and Lebanon. We'll tell you about some of the recipes that are in there. And you can find that book at restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio. Central Jersey, 1450. WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Claudia Roden is an expert on North African and Middle Eastern cuisine. She's written many books on the subject, and her current book is Arabesque, A Taste of Morocco, Turkey, and Lebanon. Now, reading a cookbook on Middle Eastern cuisine for a Western audience, I think something that's very helpful in this book, Claudia, is in the beginning, you take people through a tour of some of the more prominent spices of that you're going to talk about in the book and use in these dishes. And these are spices that Westerners may not be as comfortable with. Will you talk to us about the use of spice in Northern African and Middle Eastern cuisine?
If anybody has traveled to the Middle East or North Africa, and they've been through Spice Street in the bazaar, they just will know how intoxicating it is, and all the varieties of powders, orange, brown, and yellow, and all kinds of seeds and pieces of bark and petals, and almost everything that gives can give flavor is given, is sold. Now, I feel that in London in particular and in New York, when I go there, because I go quite often, I have a daughter who lives in New York, and I do find that certainly the chefs are using all the spices and aromatics that I use in Middle Eastern or North African. I mean, there are, apart from saffron and turmeric that you mentioned, there is cardamom, there's cinnamon, there is allspice, there is cumin, coriander. Have I just said that?
Yeah, no, we've got it. The list is complete. It's not complete. The list is accurate.
Yes, but there are some spices that perhaps you haven't started using, like sumac. Mm-hmm. And sumac is a red berry that is ground also. You can have it as a powder, and it is very lemony in flavor. I have encountered it in restaurants. There's also various aromatics like pomegranate, molasses.
Mm-hmm. And just a quick word about sumac. Actually is a relative to the poison sumac that we're familiar with here in this country, and
right.
And now is becoming more and more available.
About the different spices, I think one of the things that's wonderful when you get a book like this in the United States, yes, in New York there are reputable spice merchants where you can, and you know, spices being fresh is very important. So in New York and London we can get these spices. Now, I don't know about in the rest of England and Europe, but I'm assuming it's similar to the United States. Online,
yes.
You can find some just about anything you need and have it overnighted to you.
Exactly, and it's the same. I know a lot of people here that buy online.
Now, I alluded to earlier, we had a gentleman on the show just recently. He's a chef at a wonderful Indian-American restaurant in New York, a guy named Floyd Cardos, who's a chef at Tabla, and he probably uses more spices than any other restaurant in New York. But one of the things that he really thinks is extremely important is that people maintain their spices, buy them in small quantities, and use them the spices when they're fresh. How important is the care of spices to the Middle Eastern cuisine we're talking about?
Well, it is relatively important. I think we don't need to go over the top about that. And, you know, because I buy so many spices, so many. I mean, whenever I go anywhere, I buy. And then people bring me when they travel. So I couldn't possibly use them all at once.
Mm-hmm.
But I do like to buy them in smaller quantities. But whenever I've opened an old jar of spice, even a couple of years old, I could still, the flavor was still there. And the only thing is you just put a little bit more, because the flavor goes a bit. And I don't think there's something terrible about that. I think people can get a little bit sort of too worried about how long the spices have been. I mean, people do ask me, how long can you keep it? And certainly, I don't know if you've had this experience of having some that have been around for a long time, and they're still very good.
Well, you lose kind of the very top end of what the spices can be, I think. It's not that they're perishing. It's not that they're spoiling.
Actually, no, they don't spoil. And sometimes you just have to put a tiny bit more than you would have put.
Now, let's talk specifically about your book, your current book, Arabesque. It's not a book about Middle Eastern cuisine. You specifically chose the cuisines of Morocco, Turkey, and Lebanon. Why those three countries of all the countries cuisines you
yes.
could have chosen?
Yes, I could have chosen Syria and Iran. And I did tell the publisher at the time that they were great cuisine. And in fact, Syria, I shouldn't say, is at least as good as Lebanon. And it is similar, but different, because Lebanon was part of Greater Syria, and it's the same culture. but Lebanon has acquired the position of being, in a way, represented the food of the Arab world because they have gone into the tourist trade, whereas Syria hasn't. But when I told the publishers, well, we could have Syria and Iran, they said, no, 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 no.
Yeah, the political climate isn't right for that.
I said, maybe what we'll do is the next book I'll do the cookery of the Axis of Evil. And we'll put them in.
I don't know that that's going to be a big seller. I don't know.
We actually are very fortunate here in New Brunswick. We have a very large Lebanese community, so there's
yes.
So we've been fortunate
that's right.
to get a lot of
People do know Lebanese food because they have been big migrants, and they have emigrated in every country in the world almost, and they have opened restaurants, and they've been great restaurateurs. Turkey, too, the thing is these are the best cuisines, but certainly Lebanon and Turkey were the two countries of the Middle East that had a restaurant tradition for historical reasons. Other countries didn't have a restaurant tradition. And Morocco has a great cuisine for their historical reason that it was the capital, or rather the center of a huge empire that sort of covered Spain at one time and all of North Africa and also part of Africa. And when you are the center of an empire, you usually do develop a great cuisine in the capitals, in the courts. So it does have a better cuisine than, for instance, Tunisia, Algeria, Libya, and other North African countries.
Now, Morocco was under French rule for a long time. I actually spent a little bit of time in Tangier and Asila.
Yes.
And I found there to be a lot of French influence in the cuisine. Would you consider that a legitimate part of Moroccan cuisine, or is that
No, I think it doesn't have much. I think now it has appeared, maybe. The thing is, the French were a long, long time in Algeria, and Algeria was part of France, whereas Morocco was a sort of protectorate, and for not as long. And the Moroccan families did not absorb, they remained more separate than to the French communities, the French pieds noirs, because the French pieds noirs, the great sort of absorption of French culture was in Algeria and to a certain degree in Tunisia, but much less so in Morocco. But I think it was the influence came even after the French left, in a way, because the Moroccans did not have their own restaurants. When I went many years ago, all the top restaurants were French, and it was the case in most of the countries around the Mediterranean. There was no grand restaurant that served local food, and it's only very much later, I don't know whether it is 20 years ago or 15 years, 20 years ago maybe, I realized when the first grand restaurant opened that were serving French food. Not French, but Moroccan dishes.
You know, we're about to go to a break, but when we come back, I want you to talk a little bit about argan oil. And I think people won't believe how it was traditionally made. I think we're going to shock and amaze you.
With ingredients from Claudia Roden. The book is Arabesque, A Taste of Morocco, Turkey, and Lebanon. Back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't, based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. We're speaking with Claudia Roden about Arabesque, the taste of Morocco, Turkey, and Lebanon, her current book.
Claudia, I referred to a product right before the break called argan oil, and Francis and I mentioned this once on a program a long time ago, but can you talk to our audience about how argan oil was traditionally made?
Yes. Well, it comes from the nut of a yellow fruit of the of a tree called the argan tree, and that grows exclusively in southwest Morocco, and it has a very pleasant nutty flavor, and it's used especially as a dressing.
Goats specifically really enjoy the flavor of argan fruit.
Well, yes, and people who go around there, they see goats famously, and they're always climbing into the trees, and they jump from one branch to another, eating and munching those fruits. And then the pulp is digested and the stone is expelled. Now, the women used to go and pick up, what they expelled, those stones. And they collected them, they washed them, they cracked them.
Sounds kind of gross, Claudia.
Well, to release the nuts. And they crushed that to get the oil. When I was there, I met a lot of young women who now they've got a cooperative to produce that. And I think they use other methods now.
We no longer have to wait for the nut to travel all the way through the goat. We can just use the
exactly.
Stone.
And by the way, if the oil gets stale, because it does get stale quicker than other oils, if you taste it and it's not nice anymore, just put it on your face at night instead of cream. It's a wonderful cream.
I'm probably not going to do that, Claudia. I hope you don't mind.
And Claudia, I've seen Mark. I know this is radio. It's probably not going to help him. So.
And you would think if a stone could make that kind of a journey and still be usable, that it would have a very long shelf life.
Yeah. I want to talk about another issue. There are so many wonderful things in your book, but one of the things that you spend quite a bit of time talking about is couscous and the evolution of couscous and how it exists in a couple of different cuisines in the Middle East. Can you talk to us about couscous?
Yes. Well, couscous is really something of North Africa. It does exist in Lebanon, but it is quite different. It's also Palestinians have their form of couscous. And in Lebanon and Palestine, it is like a little round pasta. And it's very tough. Well, not tough, but it needs a lot of cooking. It isn't like the couscous of North Africa. The word couscous refers to the grain as well as to the whole combined dish, which is also broth with meat, chicken, or fish, and with vegetables.
So here in this country, we think of couscous, we think of just the grain. We don't think of the
whole dish.
The whole dish.
Right, because on menus you sometimes see couscous. Oh, yes, you're right. But in Morocco, they use the whole, they mean the whole meal as well. But what it is, it's a processed grain. It's semolina, made from hard wheat, or rather durum hard wheat, which has been ground, then moistened and coated or rolled in flour. And the resulting granules are cooked by steaming, traditionally.
Now, is there a big difference between traditionally produced couscous and kind of industrially produced couscous, with the march of modernity? What's the difference?
Yes. Well, the industrially produced couscous, I did go to a couscous factory, and what it is pre-steamed, pre-cooked in a way.
Huh.
It is pre-cooked. All of the ones that you get in packets or boxes, they are pre-cooked. And actually, when I was there, I was asking the owner of the factory how you advise people to cook it? And he said, well, you know, people here, they are so used to steaming that they go on steaming, although they don't need to. It's part of their culture. They even steam rice and they steam vermicelli, they steam pasta. But actually, you can just add water and then heat it through. You can heat it through in the oven. You can even, a lot of young women, he said, now heat it through in the microwave. I haven't done that because I haven't got a microwave. But he was saying, of course, you can, if you do just a small amount, you can just heat it in a pan. And my view is that we mustn't be more royalist than the king. If they, and I've found that a lot of people do it because I've looked into many restaurant kitchens, and I've seen them using the pre-cooked in Paris, and one or two in Morocco as well. And also, I was asking a lot of people, because I've got a place in Paris, and I have a lot of relatives even who came from Morocco. They were Jews, they are still Jews from Morocco and Tunisia. And they were saying, they were doing their Friday night couscous. And I would say, did you do it from the packet couscous that's pre-cooked, or did you steam all the way? And they said, of course I did the real thing. I would never use. And then I would ask their daughter, and their daughter would say, of course she did.
That's beautiful.
So, look in those people's pantry and look for the boxes.
Tradition meets modernity. Claudia, I'm afraid we have to leave it there. It's been wonderful of you to come on our show. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Claudia.
The book is Arabesque, A Taste of Morocco, Turkey, and Lebanon. Its author is Claudia Roden. She joined us from her home in England. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, of Stage Left and Kevin Lombardi.
You know, one of the great things that we talked about earlier about this book is the ingredients and some of the spices that are available to us now and some of the things that you can get online. We talked earlier about an ingredient called sumac. And sumac is a wonderful, wonderful ingredient that we actually used sumac powder and dusted venison with back on a menu maybe or two ago. And it's got this great kind of a little bit sour, almost lemony flavor to it, and really can add a lot of complexity and a very interesting component that sumac simply doesn't taste like anything other than sumac.
I have another unique taste from Morocco, and I traveled in Morocco as a young man. And one of the things that was striking there is they have a very great culture of tea, but Moroccan tea is a very specific kind of tea. It's a mint tea, not like you find it at Celestial Seasonings. I searched for, I'm going to say 12 or 14 years to find true Moroccan tea.
Oh, I remember.
And I've always looked for it, and I had never been able to find it outside of Morocco. I found it, and I want to share it with everyone. It's actual tea. It's green tea and mint in a very specific kind of mint in a blend. In New York City on Christopher Street, there's a tea salon called McNulty's Tea Salon. We'll put the link up on our website. I think you can call them and order it by phone. But the Moroccan mint tea from them is delicious. You should make the tea fairly strong. You should steep it for 3 minutes. And the thing about Moroccan tea is it always must be very sweet. It's always served with a lot of sugar, and I usually drink my tea with no sugar. Moroccan mint tea, very sweet, from McNulty's Tea Salon. If you want a little bit of Morocco, it's right there. It's right there. And I literally, you know that I would be tasting mint teas.
I'm going to tell
years.
You that Francis tasted 50 mint teas, dubiously calling themselves Moroccan mint tea.
It didn't.
This is not Moroccan mint tea.
You can't say Moroccan mint.
Moroccan mint tea. There, I did it just once. I can't say it twice, though.
I hope you enjoyed the hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Shaw.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are The Restaurant Guys. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.